Hello and welcome to the Iota Unum podcasts from the Latin Mass Society. In the company of some great friends of tradition from around the world, we will be drilling into some of the fundamental issues affecting us today in the church and the world.
A major motivation of this book is the annoyance we felt, as I mentioned earlier, about the attacks on the monarchy, not only by atheistic secular republicans, but by Catholics, even traditional Catholics. On the surface, their complaints appear to be inspired by various substantive disagreements with the people in power, for example, over the Abortion Act. To suggest, however, because the wrong laws have been passed, we should reject important elements of the political system that produced these laws is a conclusion born of helplessness and frustration and not rational thought. It is perfectly obvious that insofar as Queen Elizabeth II had any influence on her country, it was in favour of our shared Christian heritage, not against it, and that any alternative head of state we could imagine emerging from our current political elite would be far more woke and anti-life than King Charles III. I don't, in fact, think that this is really fundamental to objections to the monarchy. The English-speaking world is culturally dominated by the United States. So Jamie's talking about Ireland, but the United States is a sort of culturally downstream from some of these Irish attitudes as well. And this is true for Catholics as well as for others. The real objection to the monarchy, accordingly, is the radical Protestant and revolutionary rejection of tradition itself, which has left a mark on many people, even Catholics, without them even knowing where this influence is coming from. As well as setting readers straight on the legal principles of Britain's constitutional monarchy, therefore, I have been in pains in the chapters I have contributed to defend the very idea of tradition, which American culture ceaselessly seeks to undermine, from the level of children's cartoons to the writings of its leading political theorists. Elsewhere in the book, Charles Coulomb has done us a great service with his discussion of the American Revolution, or as he calls it, the First American Civil War, which lies at the heart of American attitudes to monarchy in general and to the British monarchy in particular. The first aspect of this that I explore in the preface is the role of a nation's political traditions in communicating its values. So here's a short extract from the preface. Britain's anti-modern traditions have not survived by chance, as the traditions of some snow-barred alpine valley might have remained unnoticed by the passage of time. These anti-modern traditions have existed alongside modernity in modernity's very birthplace. In conscious dialogue, conflict, and balance, Britain gave birth to modernity thanks in part to the political stability and social cohesion underpinned by the monarchy. Britain retained her ancient traditions in a conscious reaction to the atomizing tendencies of the modern world, which she had experienced before any other major nation. The tension between the old and the new in British culture gives it particular significance for the wider world. Tragically, the greatest global bastion of the anti-modern, the Catholic Church, succumbed in the course of the 20th century to a modern mindset in a number of ways, precipitating a crisis which will clearly take many decades to resolve. She retains the substance of her sacred office, but has shed many of its symbols. It might be suggested that, by contrast, the British monarchy retains the symbols without the substance. The symbols found in the coronation ceremony represent, for example, the Catholic doctrine that no longer animates our sovereigns in its fullness, and the executive power they no longer personally wield. However, this contrast between symbol and substance misunderstands the nature of a symbol. A symbol is a message, the assertion of a value, the expression of a view of the world. Symbols as symbols cannot lose their content any more than a message can by definition cease to be a message. Even if the bearer of the symbol does not understand it, even if he contradicts it in some way, The symbol retains its power to speak to anyone who can perceive it. Symbols of Catholic faith point to the Catholic faith whether the bearer is faithful or not. Symbols of executive power point to executive power whether the bearer exercises it personally or delegates it. It is the church, alas, that comes off worse in this comparison, because by rejecting her own symbols, she seems to be repudiating their message, which is her own. Thus far from the preface. I also wanted to say something about the relationship between the distinctive traditions of a political community and its coherence as a community. This is from a later chapter. I would define traditions as those practices which have been performed by our predecessors, ancestors, predecessors in the faith, previous incumbents, in the roles we fill, and so on, which A, have been continued over time by successive generations, not necessarily without breaks, and B, have been regarded as significant, and are therefore C, regarded as binding to some degree on the present generation. Thus, it is likely that we feel we ought, in some sense of ought, to continue various inherited cultural practices such as Thanksgiving dinners, Christmas trees, attending Shakespeare plays, and so on. There may be reasons why it is impossible on a particular occasion, and it may be that we were not ourselves inducted into the tradition in our own families. But if we see ourselves as members of a cultural group that is historically characterized by some practice, we can adopt or revive it. These things have value because things characteristic of a cultural group are markers of identity. They give members of the group shared experiences and a sense of belonging, both synchronically with other living members of the group and diachronically with previous generations. Discussions about the origins of the practices are usually besides the point. If members of a group identify them as things they ought to perform because they are members of the group, they will function as markers of identity. A cultural group must, by definition, have traditions to distinguish it from other groups. We want to be members of cultural groups because it gives us a sense of belonging. We could meet our physical needs in a bland, impersonal hotel, but what we want to live in is a home. Home is where we can relax and be ourselves. It is characterized by things that distinguish it from other people's homes. Some of these markers of identity will be specific to one's nuclear family, others to wider groupings of which one is also a member. They locate one in a group which may be of practical assistance, say in a calamity, in terms of who we feel ourselves to be and where we are located in history. They prevent us from being, in Pope John Paul II's striking phrase, prisoners of the present. Ecclesial and political institutions include a range of cultural groups, but also have a cultural manifestation of their own. Cultural identities can be combined. One can be Irish, an American citizen, and a Catholic culturally all at once. If the church or political institutions were to weaken as cultural identities, this would weaken members' sense of unity, their solidarity. Traditions teach and manifest values, and one's induction in traditions is at the same time an induction into the values of the group whose traditions they are. A group with shared traditions, accordingly, is a group with shared values. Human beings do not absorb values as abstractions, but as embedded in what they do. This being so, not all traditions are good. Traditions are subject to reappraisal, renegotiation, and development. This can happen naturally and spontaneously or in a self-conscious way. But if all the traditions of a group were permanently in dispute, they would lose their value as markers of identity and the cultural group would be dissolved. This is all to say that if you see in the United Kingdom a high degree of concern with traditions connected with the political community, this is an indication of a state with a correspondingly high degree of solidarity. It is not despite, but because of the power of the markers of identity belonging to the state that the state can successfully incorporate into itself cultural groups without destroying either them or itself. That was an extract from chapter 12. I make no apology for taking the discussion of the monarchy back to first principles, because many of our opponents clearly have no idea what a tradition is, how it functions, and how valuable traditions can be. It really should be obvious that radically changing the most important practice of a society, its traditions, will massively undermine its cohesiveness as a cultural group. But apparently this was not obvious even to the uppermost portions of the Catholic Church, the hierarchy of the Catholic Church in the 1960s. If they didn't get it, it's not surprising that less educated and experienced Catholics don't today. The debate about the monarchy is too often conducted between people who understand its value instinctively and those who reject it instinctively, between whom dialogue is very hard work. My hope is that I can articulate both sides of the debate to some degree and in this way move things forward a little. I want to say still more about anti-traditionalism, the now long-standing tradition, as Timothy Stanley has expressed it, of rejecting tradition. An important fountainhead of this anti-tradition is to be found in the theological debates of the 17th century, as Cardinal Newman explained in his famous Biglietto speech. Here is an extract from a later chapter. The long transition from the world of the 13th century to the present was characterized by the rise of individualism. This may have been driven above all by economic and technological developments, but the process was defended and justified and opposition to it brushed aside by reference to ideology. Notably, the claim that those things which impede individualism represent unreasonable restrictions on liberty and are an affront to the dignity of the individual. This ideology, as we experience it today, is a descendant of the claims of radical Protestants of now 4 and 5 centuries ago. Similarly, while only a small remnant of hard-line Protestants today still believe in the radical depravity of the created world, in aesthetic judgment, the association of purity with simplicity is still culturally powerful. The cultural history of England and of Anglicanism has been characterized by a prolonged struggle between the tendency to simplify, cut down, individualize, and equalize, and attempts to retain or recover complexity, decoration, and hierarchy, often with reference either to the Catholic past or to Catholic influence from abroad. The British monarchy is the outstanding example of something preserved from the Catholic past. It is not just that it stands in politics and law between the individual and the God from whom all power comes. Any head of state will do this on Christian principles. But that this mediation is not something to be played down and to be embarrassed about, but to celebrate and venerate. This institution is an affront to the radical Protestant instinct, which would say that if a leader is absolutely necessary, he should be distinguished as little as possible from everyone else, because he represents a danger of venerating something other than God and something created and therefore evil. On the contrary, the Catholic instinct is that the means by which, in the circumstances of our own history and traditions, God's authority is mediated to us is worthy of veneration precisely because God is worthy of veneration. The angels and saints, even our Blessed Lady herself, are nothing without the grace of God. Since God's grace has made them something, the Catholic principle says, let us recognize this fact by according them the respect which possessing that this grace makes them deserve. The Pope, the bishops, and the clergy in general are nothing without God's grace and may not even be worthy individuals, but their office gives them genuine dignity because it was established by God to make possible our spiritual government and the provision of the sacraments. The king, too, whatever his personal qualities, warrants our respect because the office he holds is a glorious one. God has made it so by giving him the position in accordance with law and custom. That was from chapter 14, the final chapter in the book. I also have to say a lot in that chapter about St. Thomas Aquinas' understanding of monarchy and in earlier chapters on the moral questions surrounding the monarch's relationship with the actions of his state. These are too involved for a brief presentation here, you'll be happy to hear. but I hope readers will find them useful. What I can say quite briefly and simply is that Aquinas's marked preference for monarchy over other forms of government in his work De Regna is derived above all from the symbolism of a single leader of a community, standing to the community as God stands to creation. This is not to suggest that the monarch can be an arbitrary tyrant. On the contrary, his authority and what he can do with it is circumscribed by the fact that he is God's deputy and may do only what God wills in the specific sphere that is given him to govern. Aquinas' way of talking and the examples he chooses reflects the Aristotelian scientific paradigm of his day, which is why my discussion gets a bit complicated. But he is expressing something very deep that he had in common, not only with the Old Testament conception of monarchy, but with the idea of the monarchy far beyond the Judeo-Christian tradition. I discussed the cases of the Roman historian Livy and the Chinese philosopher Confucius. For all of them, the monarch, whether executive or constitutional, is the nexus between the political community and the divine realm. This remains true even when, as in the Christian tradition, the church governs the very same community in relation to its spiritual goals. This may seem surprising to those brought up on the American doctrine of the separation of church and state, but the political community as a political community must be governed in accordance with God's law, with authority derived from God, as must the individual, the family, and every other human community. This is not a view the church left behind in the Middle Ages. I'll end this presentation with a quotation from Pius XI's 1925 encyclical Quas Primas. This document established the feast of Christ the King and was a major restatement of the church's political theology at a very difficult moment in European politics and for the church's own political position in Italy. Contrary to some of the more overexcited social media commentators, reverence for the king, like our own King Charles III, I beg your pardon. Reverence for Christ the King. I seem to have missed a line or something. Anyway, my point is that, contrary to these people, reverence to Christ the King does not imply that we should not have reverence for a human monarch, but on the contrary, demands that we do. So this is what Pius XI said. Our Lord's regal office invests the human authority of princes and rulers with a religious significance. It ennobles the citizen's duty of obedience. It is for this reason that St. Paul, while bidding wives revere Christ in their husbands and servants respect Christ in their masters, warns them to give obedience to them, not as men, but as the vicegerents of Christ. For it is not meet that men redeemed by Christ should serve their fellow men. And he quotes, "You are bought with a price, be not made the bondslaves of men." Unquote. That's 1 Corinthians. If princes and magistrates duly elected are filled with the persuasion that they rule not by their own right, but by the mandate and in the place of the divine king, they will exercise their authority piously and wisely, and they will make laws and administer them, having in view the common good and also the human dignity of their subjects.
This podcast was brought to you by the Latin Mass Society. We hope you enjoyed it and would appreciate your rating the podcast on the platform you are using. If you would like to find out more, do visit our website and consider joining us or giving us a donation.